This is XTP Media.
Obviously, they're incredibly self-absorbed, so you had to kind of wait for them to finish talking about themselves. But then when you did get a word in edgeways, you could ask them, what's it like to hover? And they would explain it. And then in return, they'd say, what's it like to do train following radar at night, in cloud, at 200 feet?
Welcome to the latest episode of Extended. For takeoff. So, here are your hosts, Peter Johnson from XTP Media, Gareth Stringer from Global Aviation Resource, and Tim Robinson from the Royal Aeronautical Society.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson, and welcome to episode 98 of Aerospace Radio Station Extended. Today, I'm joined by Tim Robinson from the Royal Aeronautical Society. And Tim, of course, is the editor-in-chief of Aerospace magazine. Tim, welcome back from Singapore.
Yeah, nice to be back.
Good to have you. You're quarantined, fully fit, didn't catch anything?
Fully fit so far, yes, touch wood. Yes, I'm self-isolating at the moment.
Very good, very good. And Gareth Stringer, the editor at Global Aviation Resource. Gareth, how are you?
I'm good, thanks, Peter. Hello, everybody.
And how's that shoulder?
It's not too bad. I had acupuncture last night for the first time, so wow. We'll see if that does the trick. I was told by a former Chinook pilot on Twitter it was the best thing he'd ever done, but I'm guessing if you fly Chinooks for very long, you probably need acupuncture. So
yeah, it's not exciting for Chinooks. It was the best thing he'd ever done, actually.
And there you heard the dulcet tones of Mr. Tim Davies. Tim is the director of Fastjet Performance, where he's a high-performance consultant and public speaker. He specialises in high-performance leadership and coaching and to get organisations to work together from a paradigm of trust rather than fear. Tim's a former RAF flying pilot. He flew the Tornado GR4 and has also deployed to the Gulf and done two trips on Optelic tours. A squadron leader, he was a strategic communications planner for a three-star NATO general in Afghanistan. As both a QFI and electronic warfare officer in the RAF, he also served as the subject matter expert for the very high-profile service inquiry into the fatal accident in 2011 for the Red Arrows. Having retired from the RAF, he's now the strategy director for Aralis. Tim, welcome back to Extended.
Always good to be here. Thank you for having me on.
It's great to have you back. Tim, before we have a look at some of the news and talk about Aralis and the Tornado, of course, I'm a fan of Fastjet Performance and the blog and the podcast. I'm just finishing the feature on Mickey. Which was a really good episode, by the way. But what inspired you to do Fastjet Performance? Where did it come from?
I had issues with authority in the RAF at the time. So I decided to, I decided to write about it and got into a lot of trouble, actually. The thing was, as I'm sure you're aware, we had the United Kingdom military flying training system was being brought in across the Royal Air Force across all three services to train all the pilots. And it was an initiative by Her Majesty's Treasury, which made the funding that was available predictable year on year for the next 25 years. Because you can imagine if you were in the Treasury and all of a sudden the Air Force turn around and say, we need 28 Hawk T2s, that's a huge burden and it's not predictable. So, but the problem was, of course, it was done very poorly in the beginning. And in 2011, the squadron I was on, RAF Valley, which was 4th Squadron, was the first squadron to stand up under this new UKMF test banner. And it was very problematic indeed. So I started writing about it really in about 2012. Not so much that, I just felt that authority within the service was better placed to do something about it, and they weren't. And of course, if they had listened to a lot of people back in 2012, they'd probably be in a very different place now, but we understand why these things happen. So I started writing a little bit about human performance, that sort of thing, and it just got into a bit of a well, I wrote loads of essays, basically. That's what I was doing, was writing essays. And some of the service liked and some of the service most definitely didn't like.
Right. And if I may be so bold, you're very personal about some of the experiences you've been through. You do not shy away from the issues, some of which are both personal, but very personal and intimate for some of your guests and listeners as well. How have you felt sort of breaking that glass ceiling, particularly in a very male-dominated environment?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I talk about mental health a lot, don't I? The problems that, obviously, you know, I had and some of my men had as well. I also talk about women in aviation, which is quite interesting because a lot of women are quite supportive and a lot of people that aren't supportive of me talking about women tend to be men, which is a bit strange. Yeah. But I think, you know, men and women learn in different ways, and yet we don't cater to that in any way, shape or form within our flying training system. And we should. And that's something we're doing with Aerolist, is making sure that all content is applicable to both sexes. But no, I write about it because why not? You know, the thing about writing about mental health is I went to a service psychiatrist. In fact, it was another flight commander on the squadron. And he obviously realized that I was, you know, up against the pressure, because you have to remember there was three flight commanders and one boss on a squadron of 80 people, 80. And the boss at the time was a Jaguar, an ex-Jaguar pilot. And of course, a Jaguar squadron would probably have 9 pilots, maybe 12 max. And they would still have a boss and 3 flight commanders. So the pressure on the flight commanders and on the boss was pretty extreme. And it got to a point where one of the flight commanders came into me and said, look, He said that he'd been to a psychiatrist when he came back to from Afghanistan. He was a Harrier pilot, and it helped him a lot. So I said, let's go and do it. And so I, and the great thing about doing that, of course, is the boss can't stop you. So you literally get in the car and you drive away from the squadron. It's quite a relief. I saw this psychiatrist twice over about 4 months. And after the second session, he said, look, if you come back and see me again, I'm going to have to stop you flying. So, of course, I never went back again, did I?
That's carried really on. Common, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. He apologized later for saying that. And I think everyone learns. He was a group captain, actually. And they were useful. But there's no reason not to write about these things, because anything we say, especially when you're in a position of authority, does get picked up by the young guys and girls coming through. And I think it's helped a lot of people to be open about these sort of things, especially the struggles as a man coming through in a very sort of responsible domain like aviation. And of course, if you don't talk about it, that's absolutely fine. But then you just get pilots flying into hillsides, don't you? Yeah. And killing all the people down the back of the jet and stuff. So it's worth having a conversation about. Definitely.
Well, it's a great podcast. It's a great blog. We'll put some links into the show notes, but thanks for talking about that, Tim.
Yeah, that's right.
Should we have a look at some of the items that caught our eye in the news? So, Tim R, let's come to you first. We can't avoid, obviously, what is in the news at the moment. But let's talk about the impact on the aviation industry. We've seen airlines already go to the wall. We're seeing aircraft flying empty to keep their slots at airports like Heathrow. Where's this going to go?
Well, I mean, yeah, it's difficult to understate the impact this is going to have on the global aviation and travel industry right now. We're in the throes of a pandemic. World Health Association has just declared a pandemic. You know, it's going to be worse than, looking at the moment, it's worse than 9/11 and SARS. Lufthansa's cutting 50% of its fleet. They're growing A380s. Flybe's already gone under. You could argue, you know, perhaps with some justification that Flybe, you know, was struggling anyway, but we'll see. Coronavirus was the final straw in terms of uncertainty, and people cancelling their forward bookings. Norwegian's cancelling 15% of its flights. Airlines are grounding their fleets, and IATA, obviously the trade body for airlines, is predicting that it could cost as much as 113 billion this year in losses to airlines. You know, that's staggering amounts of money to lose. What I think is important is this is come out of really nowhere, but it's It's only one of the black swan events there now rocking the industry. We've had the 737 MAX, which has, one of the main manufacturers has seen its flagship product grounded. There's now an oil price war going on between Saudi and Russia. There's tariffs and trade disputes going on between US and Europe, adding to that. We've got the UK, latest news, probably get to that, about the UK leaving EASA, causing further uncertainty. And underlying all that, we've got climate change as well. This is not just a single black swan. This is a whole flock being injected into the engines. Yeah. We really are in uncharted territory here, and it's going to be difficult to sort of see how this reshapes the industry and who survives comes out on the other side. Air shows and trade exhibitions are being cancelled, such as Aero Friedrich Schaubrunn in Germany. Aircraft Interiors Expo is being postponed. What does this mean if other countries go into lockdown or airlines get told to stop flying? Or over here in the UK as we go into the summer air show season, it's a big one.
Yeah. There are some almost obvious death knells already being smashed in. We're seeing the grounding of almost all of the A380s at the moment. We're seeing Virgin have just retired their last A340s. Is this definitely the end of the four-engined aircraft, do you think?
It could well be. I would say never say never, but that would be an easy one for them just to sort of say, the A380, that'll be the thing that kind of finishes it off. In previous years, in things like SARS and 9/11 and earlier crises we've had, financial crisis in 2008, what happened there is that airlines found that a lot of their business passengers suddenly migrated to the budget carriers. They were rebooked onto to budget carriers, and people found the corporate travel departments found that, oh, hang on, putting our executives on EasyJet or even Ryanair wasn't the end of the world, and that changed the market in that way, and how the kind of cabins were configured and how people looked at business class and the kind of no-frills carriers. The no-frills carriers picked up a lot of business class. So what will come out of this, I have no idea. But it's going to push some airlines to the wall, maybe consolidation as well. And on top of it, you've got the kind of climate change and the other pressures of kind of flight shaming as well.
Well, I know both Gareth and I are planning trips later in the year and hoping that this, will have settled down now. But when you look at, you mentioned Boeing there and the trouble that they have, both the MAX, they've had issues, of course, with the KC-46 and the FOD issues there and the boom issues. And, of course, they've had problems with their Starliner as well. They're sitting on a massive backlog, Tim. How do you feel? 4,400 aircraft in backlog. How do you think this is going to affect an organisation like Boeing, which is not just an aircraft manufacturer? It's the US's biggest exporter, and many organisations around the world sit in its supply chain. Do you think it's at risk here?
Well, the good news for the 737 MAX is, there's no rush now to get it back into service. Put it this way, airlines are begging Boeing and begging Airbus not to deliver any more new airplanes at the moment. So the stuff they've got to fix, like the wiring bundles that the FAA has said not compliant, they've got time. The bad news for Boeing is that manufacturers are only fully paid when an airline is delivered. So all those aircraft sitting out there in the desert are racking up and draining it of cash just when the company needs, it needs to come up with some sort of moonshot, clean sheet design You know, they had the mid-size market aircraft. I think that's just sort of dead in the water now. But a clean sheet designed to take on Airbus's long-range A321 single-aisle family. Otherwise, they're looking at kind of a lost decade. So, you know, new development of aircraft, it's an expensive business. And just when you're hemorrhaging cash at the moment, at least on the civil side, it's going to be difficult. And then on top of this, they're also being hammered, by, you know, the USAF saying, we'd only use the KC-46 if we have to, which is not exactly a ringing endorsement for your tanker. And then you've got problems. You know, Starliner was a prestige project that was supposed to be, you know, returning Americans into orbit on a US spacecraft launched from US soil, and there's software problems with that. And just on the top of everything else, you know, it really is a sort of a nightmare for them at the moment.
Yeah. Well, just mentioning Starliner there. Always good for a mention, Elon Musk. I want to come to Tim Davies on this one. Elon Musk, in an article that was published in Aviation Week recently, said the time for the fighter aircraft is over. What do you think, Tim, former fighter pilot?
He says a lot of things. He does say a lot of things, doesn't he? Well, I mean, because he's quite clever, isn't he? He kind of has to say these things to keep interest in the company. And he's not wrong, of course. I mean, you know, you're sitting there facing a bunch of fighter pilots, and if you want to make an impact at a conference, say something that, you know, is going to be contestable or contrarian, of course. But he's probably right. I mean, let's be honest. In 100 years, are we going to be going, you know, manned aircraft? Or are you going to be flying on manned airliners? I very much doubt it. Or there might be someone sitting up front, you know, having some lobster and a cup of tea just to check the aircraft, you know, doing what it should be doing. But, you know, people are expensive, and also they make mistakes. Whereas, you know, I think he's absolutely right. I mean, if you look at what we're doing at the moment, one of the things that Aerolis is doing with his X variant is an unmanned variant. It's in the X program. It's been in the X program for a long time. The Royal Air Force know about it. They're very much interested in what we're doing. You can call it a remote air vehicle, or you can call it a remote carrier or a loyal wingman, whatever you want to call. But it's one of the offerings that Aerolis has. And it's the future. So all we're doing is embracing that early, I think, really. And saying, look, you know, if I've got a choice of sending, you know, 10 jets over Badlands or 10 drones, well, I'll send the drone, shall we? You know, around the pub. Yeah. You know, that's the thing. So he's not wrong. Is he?
Well, Tim, on that subject, we don't have a limitless number of men and women ready to fly a limitless number of aircraft in our armed forces these days. Do you have any sense of what the military will be doing with regard to coronavirus to make sure that we don't end up with sort of whole squadrons of Typhoon pilots self-isolating at home and aircraft sitting in hangars?
Well, interestingly, I don't, I must admit. And it's a very good call, because when I was on Force Squadron, you can imagine the students on that, they'd bomb burst at the weekend because we're all dirty little pilots, and they'd go home and play with people, and then they'd all come back bringing bugs from all over the country, from places that, you know, all the instructors that lived on Anglesey had never been to. And of course, you'd be fighting bugs and colds the whole time. And I mean the whole time. There'd always be something going. There'd always be a sore throat, scratchy throat, you know, and you fly with anything, of course, because we're heroes, right? But and they always say, you know, don't fly if you're real. It's like, whatever, you know, of course I'm going to fly. Because if you stood down everyone that had a snuffle, then the squadron would stop. Now, if you bring someone in with something like coronavirus, and we have to remember, guys, that flu is killing more people at the moment, vastly more people than coronavirus. It just seems that coronavirus might be a little bit more transmissible, I'm assuming, the World Health Organization stuff I've been reading. So if you do bring that in there, yes, it is going to shut down squadrons, but not necessarily a massive drama. You know, take the precautions. And of course, people are going to have to be careful, aren't they, of what they do when they're away from the squadron. It's just as a squadron is a bit of a petri dish, unfortunately. Everyone's using the same, that same spoon. That's what probably kept people healthy, because it had so many bugs on it they used for a cup of tea. You know, it's probably got defenses against many, many different little diseases. But yeah, I mean, you're right. You only need to find one person on a squadron, don't you? And that shuts the squadron down. One person on the squadron with this virus, and it shuts them down. So I don't know what they're doing, but they're probably a bit more forward thinking than the government seems to be at the moment.
Yeah, probably.
and Gareth, just while we're on the RAF, what seemed like a good news story, they wanted to transfer some motor gliders to Airability, a lot of popular news stories around that, but there was a bit of an issue with certification. What was that all about?
So, you could probably, I don't know if I remember all of the details, but these aircraft have been sitting, having not been flown for, crikey, how many years? I mean, somebody tell me, it's been ages, hasn't it?
Yeah, and, 3 or 4 now. Yeah.
There were seemed to be issues over the maintenance that was being carried out and whether they were fit for service and all of this sort of stuff. And I have to confess, I'd completely forgotten about them until I read the story a few weeks ago. And then you immediately think, well, hang on a minute. These aircraft have not been, you know, nobody's been able to use these for one reason or another. And suddenly they're good enough to be sort of, hesitate to use the words, palmed off. But that's kind of what my impression was at the time. But having said that, if they do get a new lease of life, and it's for people who genuinely are going to appreciate them, then all power to them.
I think I put a tweet out about that when it came out, because of course it was actually trying to find records, wasn't it, on the engineering and servicing, and trying to work out what exactly had been done to these things. I'll see if I can find the story really quickly, but yeah, that was a problem. It almost seemed like, well, we can get people from a charity to fly them and that doesn't matter, but we're not going to use them in service.
Peter, you did miss one little good news story for Boeing, I believe, is that since we last spoke, the P-8 Poseidon has been delivered to the Royal Air Force.
Yeah,
actually, I did miss that. It's lost in all the terrible news. But yeah, that was really good.
I think we can call it a good news story, can't we?
Yeah, news for the RAF.
We've had a massive capability gap for for ludicrous reasons. But hey ho.
Yeah.
I think the second one got delivered to Lossie a couple of days.
Yes.
They've got two now, I think.
Yeah, it looks good. And we were lucky enough, I think I was with you, Tim, when we were talking to the crews training in the US a few years ago back at Farnborough, when we were lucky enough to have a trip around a P-8. So, yeah, great news. Great news story there. Sorry, Gareth, that had slipped my mind in all this other miserable stuff.
It may not save Boeing, but hey-ho.
It might save us, though. It might save us. Well, on that note, let's take a quick break. And after the break, we're going to come back and talk to Tim about his tornado flying and then getting onto Aralis.
G'day, I'm Dave Homewood of the Wings Over New Zealand show, New Zealand's only regular aviation podcast series. The Wings Over New Zealand show covers all sorts of aviation topics, with a New Zealand flavour but an international appeal. From interviews with veterans and aviation personalities, to topics like military aviation, warbirds, air shows, historians, authors, museums, aviation events, and much, much more. We have an extensive archive of episodes that you can go back to, and there are new episodes coming out all the time. Search for the Wings Over New Zealand show. Oh, and by the way, we love Extended. It's a great show. Well done, guys.
This is Extended, the ETOPS Aviation Podcast.
Tim, at the time of recording, we are almost exactly 12 months since the Tornado GR4 was retired from Royal Air Force service, which I still can't quite believe I'm saying, just because we were so used to seeing her in the skies and on the front line. A year on from the retirement, a bit longer since you flew it, I know. But what's the first thing that comes to mind when you think of the GR4?
I'd be one of these really kind of one of these guys everyone hates, because I just talk about like teamwork and the squadron ethos, really. I mean, I was quite lucky. I was on a squadron called 12 Squadron at Lossiemouth, which is now a Typhoon Squadron. But that squadron was full of wastes and strays. And so, I mean, I was picked up. I know. And also it had a lot of women on it, because other squadrons seemed to not want women. And so they came to our squadron instead, which was fantastic for us because it made us more diverse. But we were led at the time by a couple of good bosses. And one of the bosses is now the Chief of Air Staff, of course, Mike Wigston.
Yeah.
And Mike Wigston was the I speak to him because of Aerolis, of course. I'm in contact with the Air Force all the time, but I still speak to him. But he dragged me across from the Navy when I was finishing off at Valley and we lost a Sea Harrier, so I had no airplane to fly. He called us all up, about 9 of us, and said, "You guys want to come across to the Air Force?" And we all said, "Yes, may as well, else we've got to go retrain on helicopters, and helicopters are evil, of course, aren't they?" So we don't want to do that. So we all went across to the Air Force, and then he turned out to be my squadron boss on 12 Squadron. And it was the thing. I mean, you have to remember back then, I think there were 7 Tornado squadrons, and now we've got 6 fast jet squadrons full stop in the Air Force. Yeah. Back then there were 7 Tornado squadrons, and 3 of those strike squadrons were based up in at Lossiemouth with the OCU, of course. You had 14, yeah. 617, and then you had 12, and then you had 15 with the OCU, and then you had the Marham squadrons that no one cared about, of course, because they're at Marham. They weren't lost. So we didn't care about those guys, but no, it was a really good squadron atmosphere. Lots of detachments, lots of op time as well. Very, very busy. But the great thing about that was you knew that you just had to burn bright for 3 years, work hard for 3 years, and then you were off that. And you were either on a QI course or you're back to Valley or Linton to teach for 3 years and have a bit of a rest tour. That doesn't happen anymore. Of course, you got back to back Typhoon tours. You got 6 years on the jet. The guys are burnt out, of course. So back then it was. It was great for me. If I had to sum it up, though, I would say that I was very fortunate to be one of the pilots that was based at Lossiemouth, and in the dying days of low level, I'll say that now. Yeah. There's always things, though, isn't there? Like in the community. Like I remember speaking to Harrier pilots and all the other pilots. I mean, we had Jaguars, Harriers. We had 2 types of Tornado at the time. I remember speaking to Harrier pilots. Obviously, they're incredibly self-absorbed, so you had to kind of wait for them to finish talking about themselves. But then when you did get a word in edgeways, you could ask them, what's it like to hover? And they would explain it. And then in return, they'd say, what's it like to do train following radar at night, in cloud, at 200 feet? And it's that thing. Every jet at a time, you know, you could ask a Jaguar pilot, you know, what's it like to use the curvature of the earth to get airborne? Because, you know, with your one bomb. You know, have you ever thought about putting a wing on the aircraft? That kind of thing. But there was, it was always interesting to see that people were very interested in that low-level strike interdiction capability that the aircraft had. And I think that was one thing. It's the low flying around Scotland, to be honest.
One more question. That's brilliant. And everybody that I spoke to for Global Aviation Resource about the around the time of the retirement mentioned exactly what you've just said about the teamwork and that it was a brilliant community to be part of. Yeah. Just bringing it back to the jet for one last question. It served such a long time, so successfully in so many theatres. Where do you think the aircraft will sort of stack up in terms of the history of the Royal Air Force? Surely it is one of our most successful and iconic jets.
Oh, absolutely. It was at war, I think, for its entire existence. It never had a break. I don't remember any time it wasn't deployed. And of course, the thing about it was David Cameron, the first thing that would happen whenever something would happen all over the globe, he would literally say, where are my Tornadoes? That's what he'd say. Where are my Tornadoes? Because he knew you could deploy them. There were 7 squadrons of them. You could also deploy parts of the ACU. You could bring them back from exercise, throw them out into theater. And all of a sudden you've got these massive war jets, and they are war jets, of course. Can carry a lot, got a huge fuel payload, and you can put them into any country, anywhere. And it was a huge deterrent, you know, is what he could do. So I think, you know, anyone that was around flying jets at the time of the Tornado has a huge amount of respect for it. And that's the thing. I know guys flying F-35 now, to be honest with you, that is a completely different machine, but they sit up there at 30 or 40,000 feet and they don't go down low level. And it's a shame. I think it's a shame. But that's, you know, crikey, that's what the F-35 does. I mean, don't get me wrong. Typhoon the same, really. I know people are saying, why bother training for low level anymore? And I'll tell you why. I wrote an essay about this, got into trouble again. But the truth is, I know. I wish I hadn't done it looking back. Oh, my life was so much. Anyway, I wrote an essay because I couldn't care less. Those men were wrong. I'll be honest with you. No, they seriously were, because now they're reaching out to me and saying, oh, Tim, you know, and I support all the Royal Air Force on Twitter. You might see I'm very supportive of the Air Force, but I still challenge it because it could do things better. And it knows it's got a problem with flying training at the moment. And it knew back in 2012 it had a problem with flying training, because I was telling them and all my men were telling them as well. Yeah. Anyway, obviously things couldn't have been done back there. People want to promote, don't they? They want to promote in rank. So of course they're not willing to rock the boat whilst they're holding the top slot. And then you end up with this problem they've got. But the issue being, when you're on red flag, when you're targeted, the one place you go is to low level. There's no two ways about it. And you hide behind a mountain and you run away, or you progress the target. At medium level, you are exposed, unless you're in something like an F-35, of course, where you can minimize your radar cross section, of course, and use your stealth abilities. But on red flag, I've seen it a thousand times. I was only on flag twice, but every single time you get engaged, what happens, whether it's a surface-to-air missile system or an enemy or a fighter aircraft coming within a certain range, is everyone detonates to the low level. They will roll the jets on the back and they all pull down about 30 degrees and they go down to the deck and they fly around 100 feet, because it's much harder to die down there. Yeah. So if you're not practicing that, you know, just saying, if you're not practicing it, then you're losing essential skill, unfortunately. But that's, it all comes down to budgets, isn't it now? So I was lucky to be in a community where there were many fast jet squadrons. You'd have, I mean, did you guys ever go and do that spotting on hills and stuff? I met some of the guys that do that. They sit there and take pictures.
I've never done that.
You've never done that? No, I went down and visited them. I went down
to see anymore, is there?
No, that's right. And that's what I'm saying. There's not much to see. It's like extreme fishing, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, you're like 3 or 4 days without seeing one. It's like, you know, which is a shame. So I was quite lucky. That was all. I was quite lucky. So I think
there is a picture of you on the Mark Loop, isn't there? On your LinkedIn page, I think.
Yeah, added to the show notes. I was very respectful of the photographers in the Mark Loop and always try and get down there and put a jet through if we possibly could. Those guys spend a lot of time and they do a lot of good work for the service by putting those things out. I think the service stopped sending people down the Mac Loop, didn't they? I think a typhoon might have done something a little bit silly, but
yeah.
So I don't think the typhoon, I think the typhoons are banned from the Mac Loop for a while.
It's a shame though. When I was a kid, I had a lot of family and sort of family friends in East Anglia. So when I was a kid, that's where we used to go on our summer holidays. Apart from the fact there's no mountains in East Anglia, you didn't need to go and stand on a hill or anything, because back in those days, the aircraft all just, you know, came to you. And actually that was an important part of, you know, what sort of inspired me, I suppose, growing up. And, it's funny. It seems like a silly little thing now, but it has gone, hasn't it? A lot of people will never see, unless they go to an air show, they'll never see a military aircraft in their life.
Well, it was like when they brought the Vulcan back, didn't they? And did the tour around Britain. I mean, seeing a Vulcan at low level, that's something that people just genuinely had not seen for years, years and years. And they managed to get that Vulcan flying again. And that was superb to see that thing at low level, wasn't it? I mean, rocking around. I love the fact they had GoPros stuck everywhere and they were flying with like iPads on their knees and just absolutely sacking off every single regulation they could possibly find. Because what people are going to do about it? They're about to get rid of the aircraft. Yeah. I thought it was lovely. I'd have had a cigarette on the burner, a cup of tea in there and everything.
I must just tell you guys, just because this has just popped into my head. When I was growing up, I grew up in Hertfordshire, so we didn't really have any military aviation. But the nearest thing to me was British Aerospace Hatfield, which was at the time, you know, great history, but was a busy factory building BAE 146s and such like. And they had an open day every year. And I remember seeing Lightnings and all sorts there. And when I was about 9, I took a photo of a Hawk T1 that was pretty much brand new into service then. And it's sitting on my Flickr account. And 2 weeks ago, I got a message through Flickr from the guy who took it into that show.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, how, you know, the beauty of the internet, eh? I mean, how extraordinary.
That's amazing.
Is that? Yeah.
Amazing.
And he was an instructor at Chivenor. And he grew up in Hertfordshire, and he knew that the event would really love to have that. And he asked his boss, can I take a Hawk to Hertfordshire for the weekend? And of course, in like 1981 or whatever, the bloke said, yeah, go on, off you go. So he did. He flew his Hawk from Chivenor to Hatfield for the weekend. And lo and behold, you know, 30 years ago, nearly 40 years ago, has seen the picture on the internet. How extraordinary is that? There we go. Anyway, listen, thank you. I could jaw away about the JR4 for ages, and I still can't quite believe it's a sight that tail, unmistakable, has gone from our skies with RAF roundels on, at least. But hey ho, we progress, we move forward, don't we? And that's a great segue for what you're doing now. I'm gonna hand over to Tim R.
Sure. Yeah. So I suppose from the past to the future of your future. So, Tim, you are strategy director, I believe, at Aerolis. So, for the people just joining us now who maybe not checked out the website, read any of the aviation news, just explain in a nutshell what is Aerolis.
In a nutshell, right? Yeah, good. Yep. What Aerolis is a modular aircraft capability for flying training. This is in a very small nutshell. So it was an aircraft
design for military flying training and for aggressive programs with the X-Fair. And there's three different types of the aircraft, but they all use modular approach, which is comes from the civil aviation and the airline industry, in effect. If you know airlines, if you buy, if an airline is an Airbus airline or a Boeing airline, of course, you tend to pick one of those two companies because all the spare parts and everything, they're all the same, and it helps you maintain all your fleet. So, and that's exactly what we're doing, because flying training aircraft don't need to be expensive. Frontline aircraft most definitely do, of course, don't get me wrong, because they carry external stores and they have real radars. But in flying training, we can emulate that through synthetics, and that's exactly what we do at Aerolis. So the aircraft has a common core fuselage, three variants. There's a basic, an advanced, and then there's what we call the X. The basic is a single engine aeroplane, a straight wing, top speed about 360 knots. The advanced, twin-engined, swept wing, about 550 knots, very comparative to Hawk, the advanced is. And then the X variant is anything other than the A or the B. So if you want a real radar in your aircraft, well, the A and B don't have that. So I'll take you into the X program and we'll install a real radar and we'll get the certification done and then you can have that. But the idea being of the aircraft is a very low cost way of delivering flying training and aggressive capability across many air forces. The key, if the takeaways, if it is, it actually reduces costs by 30% over the lifetime that you own the aircraft, which actually over 25 years is equivalent for fleet size of two frigates. So you can see now why it's very interesting for a lot of militaries. And that's because it has 85% commonality of parts across the fleet of aircraft itself. It's all synthetic. Okay. That's the key to remember. There's no live drop capability on this aircraft at all. There's no real radars. It's all data link. And then the X variant has capabilities. X variant is outside the flying training program. And that's independently verified by Fraser Nash, by the way. So we had to do that before we could actually raise any capital.
And the idea as well is that if you have these two variants and you've got a basic trainer, you've got an advanced trainer, you can mix and match them. You can optimize your fleet, and you can flex them and surge them. And
that's right.
You can therefore react quicker to these things, which we have in MFTS there, where, you know, people are waiting 7 years to get on a frontline squadron because, you know, there's that sort of shortage. You know, there's not enough aircraft or pilot instructors built in.
That's right. That's right. That's exactly it. Yeah. So the surge capability is something that we're developing to put in the UK as a flying school, an aerialist flying school. And what we actually do with the aircraft is it's a data gathering machine also. So we take all the data from this and we gamify the flying training process. And then the data, we actually have something called, you may have heard of it in industry. It's a digital twin. Normally a digital twin is sort of used as an engineering term to say, well, this is what we think is the aircraft, and we have a digital twin of it, and now we can map the progress of the aircraft or the component against this digital twin. What we're using is a digital twin as a human, as an avatar in effect. So we know the ideal fighter pilot that should come out at the end of the flying training. We know what that is. And so we then take that line all the way back to the very start. We recruit people who are that fighter pilot at the start of his training or her training, and then we match them all the way. And what that means is we can flex the syllabus also. So it's a flying training system, not an aircraft. Aerolis is a flying training and an aggressor system, not purely an aircraft. It's a whole system of subsystems. And so we use that data as well, and that data can be used across other industries, other high-performance industries as well. So it's a very interesting project. It's one, obviously, I've been dragged into. And right now we're in a third round of funding. So if you have millions of pounds, please get in contact with me. I think we're funding about £40 million to get the A variant built and the B variant as a static technology demonstrator. So we'll have a flying A variant hopefully by 2023. We are in contact with the Royal Air Force. They're fully aware of us. We do speak to air capability a lot. And of course, the aggressor aircraft is one that they're interested in, because if you think about the Hawk T1 that they've got on at the moment, it is a problematic aircraft. It was made in 1974. And the T2 has serviceability issues, unfortunately, and it always has had. It's just a 1974 design, isn't it? This is one of the things. And so they're very interested in what we can do to assist them in that. It's not designed to replace anything. It's designed to as an add-on capability.
And potentially the X version as a Red Arrow platform, because I mean we'd had the Red Arrows doing a great tour of the US sort of last year, and you know, but
yeah.
You know, it was, you were looking at that thinking, oh, crikey, this is a little bit of Antiques Roadshow, isn't it? You know, if promoting British industry of over 40-year-old jet. You know, couldn't you get something a little bit newer, guys? So potentially a Red Arrow.
There is an issue with the Air Force, isn't there, over this? The problem is with the Air Force. You drag me back in again, Tim. You drag me back in again. I love the Air Force. But I actually spoke to the Air Force and said, look, come on, you're demonstrating British manufacturing technology, the British aerospace sector, with a 40-year-old airplane. And they said, well, isn't that great that we have an aircraft that can last for 40 years? I'm like, no, you're just showing that you can't do anything else. You don't have an inherent build capability for a whole aircraft design in the UK. When was the last aircraft we designed solely within the UK? It was the Hawk back in 1974, military. Okay. So, and this is one of the problems. It's like, how are you demonstrating your aerospace capability by flying? You've seen inside a Hawk T1. My wife has an MG Midget. And when she flew in a T1, I got one of my men to fly her when I was at Valley many years ago. The first thing she said to the pilot, she said, oh, it's like my MG Midget because it's got the big like dials. It's like, the pilot was like, okay, turn the mic off for the rest of the sorting, you know? Stop talking. But it is a very, I mean, the guys that fly it, the guys at 100 Squadron, 736, and I know them all, they're lovely guys. And they do enjoy the aircraft because it's raw, you know, it's raw flying. The Reds very much enjoy it. I'm not building an aircraft for the Red Arrows. What I'm building is an aircraft that the Red Arrows can use. What will probably happen, I think, is we'll get our aircraft dragged into Valley and then the T2s will end up in the Reds maybe, because you'll need that many T2s to provide 9 aircraft serviceable on the line, probably. You need 28 T2s, you know. But unfortunately, they do suffer a little bit. But then again, you park them on the beach at Valley, don't you? You know, you wonder why they're suffering. But it's, I think what will happen, I don't see the Reds being a Red Arrows team. I don't see the Red Arrows existing in the current form past about 2025, because you need those pilots to be doing something operational. I think what will happen is those pilots will be part of an aggressive squadron, probably part of a 100 squadron, and they will do a more limited display over the weekend. And then they might fly 3 days of the week with the aggressors and have maybe Monday and Tuesday off. I think that's probably the way we're going to be going in the future. There's 46 different types of aircraft in the Air Force, isn't it? And they're trying to get that down to less than a third of that number, really. Much more sort of civilian context of servicing and everything else. And this is exactly what the airless aircraft is being designed to do, is to reduce that cost and to make the aircraft, you can use the X-Variant as an aggressor / display. So on 100 Squadron, you're just displaying with, I mean, paint some aircraft on 100 Squadron, just paint them red if you want, and then display them on the weekend, a more limited display. But the problem is, though, Tim, you can't convince the Reds of this, of course, because what you're trying to say is you're going to cease to exist as the premier aerobatic team in the world. No one's going to listen to that. Yeah, and it's fine. I get it. I'm not trying to hurt anyone. Don't get me wrong. I know all the guys, and it's just it is what it is. I don't think anyone can really see them existing past 2025. It's just a different world now.
Well, on that bombshell, let's just drill back to you took the gamification of flight training first off, what is gamification in the first place, and secondly, what can it do for the military flight system? Is it going to produce a better pilot or a quicker one or a personalized syllabus where, you know, if someone's an ace of the base, they can race through it, or someone else will get extra training, how would you argue it against somebody who said, well, you know, gamification, you know, is this Fortnite? Is this Call of Duty? This sounds too much like a fad, and encouraging students to faff around high scores and things like that. What are we talking about here?
Yeah, that's fine. I mean, you pretty much nailed it there. That's pretty much exactly what it is. Well, what I try and get across to people is, look, we are dinosaurs, okay? So let's stop thinking we're not. We are dinosaurs. These people that come, look at the Formula One drivers, okay? They're in the early 20s, late teens, early 20s, and they are driving Formula One cars. If you want to know how to learn how to drive a Formula One car, you don't ask someone in the mid 40s. You go back to these young people and you say, what have you done? And they're all on video games. They're all on video games, and that's what they do. They learn the circuit on video games. And of course they do, because Formula One cars are expensive. And I was recently, I gave a talk down at Renault Formula One. So I'm supporting them this year, by the way. And I talked to them, and it's exactly what their drivers do. Now, if you want to know how students learn, then you go to the students and you say, what are you doing in the evenings to brush up for your trips the next day. And they will all give you slightly different answers, but a lot of it is the chair flying, the visualization. They will go on the little simulated devices in the building. They will use each other. So courses ahead, brief courses below. And we tried to stop that. And then we realized at Valley, we said, well, hang on a second, why are we stopping this? And a lot of the old and bolds, like myself, I wasn't one of these people, by the way, were saying, well, you've got courses ahead trying to teach the courses below informally, but they might be teaching them incorrectly. And I said, as OC standards on the squadron, look, well, at least they're teaching them. So at least they're saying, look, this worked for me. And at the moment, that is that actually worse than not teaching them? So what we're trying to bring in Aerialists is we're trying to say, let's respond to the individual. Every training course is bespoke, which means we're not onboarding six students at any one time. We're onboarding students at whenever we need to onboard a student. Now, that student's progress is determined by the student's ability and their aptitude. So we gamify the syllabus, which means that you have many learning formats. You can either do like the role play, you can do the visualization, which is watching videos, you do the audio, of course, or you can read something. There's many different ways that people respond to different content, of course. It might be, and this happens, women and men do respond differently. They tend to end up at the same place, but they do respond differently. So it's important you get that right piece of content in front of them. So we gauge that content. We look at what they're using, and then we look at how they're performing. And we flip in other content as well. We put different content in. We say, oh, this guy's mainly a video guy. Well, let's see what happens. And we put a couple of, like, just basically some reading material in front of him and see what his performance is. We track it. Then we work out how best they're learning. And then we gamify it as well. So they start off as an avatar. And we're working closely with Talis and some other companies with this as well. And they're fully on side, fully briefed up. And they're very supportive of it. They're great, great companies to work with. We're very lucky at Aerialists. But we go through, we see how they're performing, and we track the metric. So there's a line. Basically, the line will take you from the day you walk into an Aerialist squadron to the day you walk out. That's the line. You need to be on that line. So if you're above that line, well, I can now remove sorties from the syllabus ahead of you because you don't need them, or I can put them in the simulator and not airborne, because we only reckon about 30% of this course is going to be flown airborne anyway. If you're below the line, I can then slide in other evolutions for you. I can give you extra simulation. I can give you extra virtual reality, augmented reality briefs. I can give you extra materials to learn from and bring you back to the line. The key is to keep people on the line, not to accelerate people too far, not to let people drop down below. But that means every course is bespoke, which means that people can move up and down different, not courses. We're not even looking at courses, but they are literally just an avatar for us. And then we collect that data, we refine it, we use it on the next people coming in, and eventually we've narrowed it down to exactly what an individual is required from the moment they come in to the moment they actually leave. And also we are able then to understand exactly how we should be onboarding this student. So what is the student we need to be selecting for optimal efficiency throughout our flying training system? So as Fast Jet Performance, I've got a PhD student in the States at the moment. She's in her mid-30s. She's doing a lot of work on this. She came from the medical field. Her whole PhD is on this whole thing. That's why she's working for me. And some of the stuff she's coming out with is radical. It's almost like I do not know why this is not being used already. In fact, Pilot Training Next, of course, are looking at themselves in America. So, you know, eyes are on this. Just we're doing it better than everyone else.
Tim, can I start from a military perspective? Have you been able to learn much from the likes of Raptor and F-35, where we don't have any two-seat aircraft? So the pilot's first trip in the aircraft is literally his first solo. Are there lessons to be learned from those programs already?
Yeah, one of the things we're looking at is not having an instructor in the airplane the whole time as well. I mean, I think that's quite important that we move away from those days. These aircraft, when you talk of F-35 and things like this, these are not difficult. Oh, I'm going to get so many spears from my friends. They're not difficult aircraft to fly. The difficult aircraft to operate. There's a fundamental difference. So when you fly the Tornado, the Tornado was a hard aircraft to fly. It was mandrolic, we call it. So it was very pulling levers and moving throttles and rocking throttles outboard and all this kind of stuff. And it was very easy to get stuff wrong, especially at slow speed in the big jet. Typhoon won't let you stall, and F-35 will just fly you home and make you cups of tea and all sorts of stuff. So we're not necessarily worried about putting pilots in this by themselves. We're worried about them operating these aircraft. And what we can do, of course, is we can look at that in the simulator prior to them actually operating them. We can fly on the wing if we want to. And of course, what we're looking at is with Aerialists is to have a lot of these sorties actually being done in the simulator anyway, and tied in with Datalink with the aircraft. So I think the days are the days are moving on now. Of course, here's the thing, though. You know, let's see one of these guys bring back a jet in a 40-knot crosswind at Valley on a wet runway. So we do have to kind of make sure that we do have that instructor involved in the loop. But it is something the Air Force are looking at, and the Air Force are looking at it probably primarily because they don't have enough instructors. And that is, honestly, the Air Force's fault, to be honest.
And finally, I suppose the final question is, you mentioned sort of, you know, the UK's whole aircraft design capability and, you know, have that arguably has been lost. You know, the light bulb, I think, has gone on. We've now got Tempest in the military world. We've got Bird of Prey in the civil world of people trying to say, hey, we need to build the whole aircraft. So yours fits in with that in kind of getting that excitement back, getting that sort of stem. How do you think it kind of leads into or overlaps Tempest in that way? Do you see it complementing sixth-gen fighters?
Yeah, I mean, I do. Don't get me wrong. I can't be too open here, guys. I'd love to be more transparent and honest. One of the things you realize when you come into the civilian world is that you do that and then people start suing you in courts and they don't, they're no fun anymore, are they? So, but we have, let's just say that BAE Systems know who we are. Fine. They're not making any more Hawks anymore. We know they've got money for Tempest coming in, and they obviously Tempest is this thing they're going to build for sixth generation, and their responsibility for sixth generation is also to train pilots for sixth generation, and there isn't anything they've got or anyone's got that can do that at the moment. If you go M346, if you these aircraft are back from the 70s, of course, and we all know this, they're very nice airplanes, very very expensive airplanes, but again, not embracing sixth generation technology. And of course, I get bantered by F-35 pilots all the time saying, TB, talk about sixth gen. What is sixth gen? I'm like, what's coming after fifth gen? That's what it is. You tell me what sixth gen is because no one knows. But of course, that's it. Everything evolves, doesn't it? And so, as I said, BAE Systems know who we are. They're not building Hawk anymore. I don't want to say too much about this, of course, because it's not fair on BAE Systems, but they are. They are, what's the best word to say? They are aware, and they do need something in front of Tempest. And, at DSEI last year, there was us, and then, of course, BAE Systems come and install their stand right next to us, blatant, trying to get in. Of course they did. It might have been us that actually kind of installed next to them, to be honest with you. So we do see ourselves slotting right in there, yeah. And the great thing is, we've got lots of friends within the company to when you look at the capabilities of some fantastic companies like KBR and Thales and people that, are alongside us with this, it starts to become a very, very credible British success story. And I think that's the opportunity that this government does not want to miss. This is something, especially post-Brexit, that will demonstrate the capabilities of the UK aerospace industry. But I'll be honest with you, it is stagnant in the UK, and I do not know how we've allowed it to get in the state it is. The agility of some of these large companies is exceptionally poor. So it sometimes is maybe the younger startups or the small agile companies that are possibly going to be the future of these of this whole aircraft design and whole aircraft build in the United Kingdom. I don't know what you guys think about that.
What are the international opportunities looking? I mean, is Aerolis on foreign air forces radars now? Maybe we shouldn't kind of buy a Boeing Saab T-7, and just wait and see what happens here. Are they now? Is that kind of are they aware of this project that's going on?
Yeah. So one of my jobs was obviously bouncing around defence attachés in London and speaking to them. So we did that. I can't tell you the countries, but you know who is looking at purchasing aircraft for their flying training fleet within early 2020s. And we know who they are as well. We've done that market report. We know the size of the market we're looking at, and we know the number of aircraft we have to build. And it's in the hundreds. Let's just say that. It's a very, very big market. It's very, very open. And you can go and buy a T-7 if you want to, but you are going to pay the big money. You know what I mean? It is not a cheap aircraft. And also, why would you want a T-7? I mean, let's honestly look at that. This is a classic. This is, we're going on a rant now. I'm not going to rant. Stop me. This is a classic. What do we think looks good? Well, let's get a supersonic aircraft. Why? I don't know. Let's make it turn at 9G. Let's put a small little wing on it. I mean, it's everything you don't want or don't need in a flying training aeroplane. I think the T-38 does one trip where it goes supersonic. And it's like trip two, and there's no difference. I mean, you know, crikey. And then they go and land, and they go, there you go, no fuel, brilliant. So we don't need that, and we're not building that. No, ours is modular, it's exceptionally cheap. The T7 is not an inexpensive aircraft. It's ferociously expensive. Why people buy that airplane is because they're buying it on the back of an F-35 deal or something like that. So a lot of this stuff is political. We understand that. Don't get me wrong. And the countries I speak to, the countries obviously that we targeted and that we speak to and that we know have a requirement, look at the aircraft that Aerodis are building and they understand it. I did an interview with a magazine recently and they did say, the interviewer did say to me, do you think your customers are not able, they actually said something else. They said, do you think all customers are too stupid to understand Aerodis? And I said, yeah, let me just go and say all my customers are stupid. Yeah. But the truth is sometimes you can leap ahead of industry. And that is a problem for a lot of younger companies all over the world. And we realize that part of our success is going to be able to message this product correctly and what it does and what it can actually offer the customer. And what it does, of course, offer them is a massive 30% reduction in costs because of the 85% commonality of parts. That's understandable because if you understand the airline industry and you understand why an airline will buy all Boeing or an airline will buy all Airbus, then this is exactly the same. There's no difference here. The engine is in a nacelle, for crying out loud. You know, so airliners have a nacelle for a reason. You can put different engines in there. So if a customer wanted to put their own engine in there, all we do is recertify the nacelle as part of the aircraft. It's not a massive drama. They might have their own indigenous power plant that they want to use. So it's a very, very flexible system. And this is what makes it so interesting to so many people. But yes, we do have countries all over the world that I do speak to on a regular basis.
Fantastic.
Tim, can I just ask, how did that sector come to be so stagnant in terms of development and aircraft types? Because it's not just Hawk, is it? It's T-38, an Alpha Jet, MB-339. You know, you can almost look through some of the display teams, can't you? These aircraft have all been around for donkey's years.
Yeah, it is, absolutely. I mean, it's very easy, isn't it, to not update a display team. I remember when I think it was the Thunderbirds, they wanted like a block 60 F-16 or something. And they were told, no, you don't need that. We need that on the front line. You know, you need the oldest F-16 we can find because you're going to bounce wings anyway. I mean, you know, you're going to dent the jets anyway, aren't you? So it's very easy to leave those older aircraft within display teams and paint them bright colors and no one knows. I just think it's there is a stagnation, most definitely. I don't think the problem that we've had over the years is that we've always designed a flying training aircraft / lightweight fighter. And no one's ever used it as a lightweight fighter. So look at Hawk. Hawk was supposed to shadow F-3s and was going to fire, a 9 Lemur at someone. It was never used.
Airfield defense.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Against what? Dolphins? I mean, what are you using it against? You know what I mean? It's going to fly around Anglesey shooting dolphins that are invading the island. I mean, that's the problem, I think, with it, is the M346, of course. I mean, it's a fantastic platform, but the reason it's expensive is because it hangs real bombs off it. And who's really going to use it as that? You know, if it's in your flying training system, you're never going to go, actually, tell you what, guys, here's a backup fleet in case, you know, the hordes invade over the mountains. We can use these aircraft for it. That's not how it's going to work. You probably won't even certify the weaponry that's supposed to go on it because there'll be no point. Because there'll be no point in students in flying training dropping, you know, GBU 32s or whatever. So why would you bother certifying that? And if you did want to certify all your aircraft involved in flying training anyway. So I think the days we've recognized this, we've said this is not a fighting airplane. This is, don't use this for fighters. I mean, if you want the aggressor in the X-Varium, yeah, we can talk to you and we can do things with that, most definitely. But you're not in the A and B program because the A and B program is cheap because of the fact all the aircraft are the same and they're all synthetic. So we've taken out that lightweight fighter and put it in a completely separate program to reduce the cost of ownership or lease ownership for these two training variants. So I just think that's how the world was back then, to be honest with you. They just made it, they tried to make one aircraft do two roles and it just made it incredibly expensive. And so they held onto them for ages. That's my theory.
Yeah.
One or two questions just before we go for another break. You've mentioned manufacturing a couple of times, and obviously this is heavy heavy into tech, and there's a lot of IT and clever stuff behind it, which can be pretty much done anywhere in the world. But where do you plan to manufacture the hardware? Is there anything special about how you're going to bring the aircraft together?
So what we're looking at is all commercial off-the-shelf technology. Obviously, we've spoken to a lot of people, a lot of suppliers, who obviously they all want to come in and furnish this airplane with their capability. If we can have commercial off-the-shelf, though, we reduce this cost vastly, and there's no reason why we shouldn't. There are issues with the data collection, the data gathering, a part of that technology, but we've been to sea quite a bit, and we realize there's a lot of capability out there. Some of it is quite expensive, and you'll probably know who I'm referring to when I talk about expensive avionic capability, but it's good. So, there we go. Depends how far you want to take it, doesn't it, really? So yes, insofar as, who's going to manufacture this airplane, initially the aircraft is manufactured in the UK. Now, what we are doing as Aerolis is making sure that we would like to have the Common Core fuselage manufactured in the UK. The rest of the aircraft, the nacelle, the wings, and maybe even the tail section, we don't mind where that's necessarily manufactured if companies want to grow their aerospace capability. And we've spoken to companies that really, really do want this. The Middle East especially would really like to be building aircraft within their own country. That is not a problem for us at all. That's actually part of what we're doing. We want to bring this to countries to grow their own aerospace capability in the same way that the courseware we're writing for this, we're going to put about 20% of it online for free to encourage civilian pilots to use that courseware. And that's twofold, by the way, because I can get free data from them, which I can use as a metric against my own students, and also it makes them safer. And the whole thing about Aerolis is we're involving a lot of people in STEM, a lot of people outside of aviation, bringing them all in together and saying, look, try and celebrate this great news story for the UK in building an aircraft that we can all be exceptionally proud of. So hopefully that makes sense.
Do you think you're ever going to fly the A or the B model?
Well, obviously I'm a legend, so yeah, I'll probably fly everything. I mean, I'm 45 now, seriously. This is what people keep saying. They keep offering me to go flying, and I'm like, I'll just make it stop. It's to be honest, I probably will. The CEO wants to learn the fundamentals of basic fighting maneuvers, and he's a very, very clever guy. I think he's got like 2 or 3 degrees or something, and he's a Cambridge graduate and all this kind of stuff. And I think one of the greatest things we can do is to put our CEO himself through the syllabus for some of the modules. We get a lot of data back from him, of course, because he won't have flown anything before, but we are going to put him through an air combat syllabus. And so, yes, myself, there's a team of people that I used to fly with, of course. I know exactly where they are, every single one of them, and know who I am. And they know that I've contacted them already, that I'm going to drag back in, kicking and screaming back into the cockpit. And those guys are going to be the first instructors to train the other instructors. And we will put the boss through a limited syllabus. To be honest with you, I've got neck damage coming out of the Air Force. I'm 45 years old. The cockpit really isn't, once you're in a cockpit like this and you're doing this, you're not doing anything else with your life. Does that make sense? I'm sure you've heard that before. It's all encompassing. Being a pilot in the Royal Air Force is what you do. There's no time for anything else. And so I know that if I went back to fly this thing, it would probably be in a capacity of, I'd probably have a passenger authorization and I'd just jump in as a PAX with one of the other instructors. I don't see myself being an instructor on this airplane. I'll probably fly both. I'll do all the sim work anyway for it. But I need to get this. I need to get younger guys coming out of the Air Force into this airplane and get them flying this. And to be honest, I mean, the director of flying training, I spoke to him recently, Jamie Hunter, used to be a boss of mine on 208 Squadron. And he gave me a call and he said, how do I get guys like you back into the jet at Valley? And the truth is, I've been out of the jet now for about 2 years, well, a year and a bit, I can't remember now. And the truth is, I would have gone back and I still would on a 50% commitment, but the truth is the Air Force wants more. It's a young man's game, you know what I mean? So does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it does. I know you've taken a little break from flying, but I just wondered what your ambitions were for getting in the cockpit of this. But thanks for that, Tim, appreciate it.
That's all right.
Right, well, thanks for providing a superb update on that. So I suppose, as they say, watch this space for Aerolis.
From across the globe, from the centre of aerospace, and now to you.
The Royal Aeronautical Society is the world's only professional body dedicated to the entire aerospace community. Established in 1866 to further the art, science and engineering of aeronautics, the Society has remained at the forefront of developments in aerospace. We will bring you multimedia, lectures and discussion from inside the world of aviation, aeronautics and space. If you enjoy our content, please consider showing your support for the Society. If you have an interest in aerospace, find out about the professional and personal benefits that Society membership offers. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
Extended. It's time to talk aviation. Email us now. Get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of extended. Aviation questions, suggested topics, or even good old feedback are all welcome.
Okay, over to promoting aerospace. Gareth. You've got an exciting announcement to make.
Well, I've picked 13 minutes to the moon, which for anyone who, I don't know about you, Tim D, myself, Peter and Tim R are big fans of the space race. Back in the day, Mercury, Gemini, Apollo, and it's something we've covered quite extensively on the podcast. And last year, the BBC World Service, presented by Kevin Fong in conjunction with Andrew Luck Baker, produced an incredible podcast series called 13 Minutes to the Moon, which was absolutely captivating, brilliantly done. Music by Hans Zimmer, the full Monty. Absolutely fabulous for the 50th anniversary of the moon landing. And lo and behold, and I have to say, I didn't see any sneak peeks or anything for this, so it dropped out of the air a little bit unexpectedly. Series 2 is out now, Apollo 13. Brilliant first episode. Can't wait to see where it goes. But listen, if anyone's missed it and they caught the first part of it last year, get on your BBC Sounds app and listen to 13 Minutes to the Moon, because it is a absolutely brilliant piece of work. I cannot praise it highly enough.
Yeah, it's great production, isn't it? It really is. Yeah. Very special. Tim R, did you come up with anything?
It's really a sort of plea for supporting airlines and their staff at the moment. They're going through a really hard time. You know, we obviously see people on Twitter, we know, who've suddenly found out they haven't got jobs, and they're going through, you know, really, really, really difficult time at the moment, and they don't know, you know, don't know what the future is going to be. So all I'd say is I understand that, you know, people have you know, you're worried about whether your holiday's been cancelled or where you're going to go at the weekend, or, you know, will you be able to visit Europe and stuff like that, and you might get angry with airline people on the telephone trying to rebook or cancel stuff or things like that. I'd just sort of say a plea to not really sort of take it out on them, and not take it out on the people there. That they're doing their best. There's humans there at the end of the line. That they're in really, you know, sort of dire straits at the moment.
Yeah, Flybe as well. Flybe went under, didn't it? And yeah. I had a friend flying for them, and unfortunately, he's a great guy, Ben Cornwell. He was does Plain Old Ben. Do you see that on YouTube at all? Plain Old Ben is a young pilot. He self-funded his ATPL. Self-funded. He was a BMW salesman up in Preston. I gave a talk for them. Lovely bloke. Self-funded it. Like every weekend, he'd do some extra flying, that kind of stuff. And he went to Fly B on the Dash 8. Fantastic airplane, fantastic handling airplane. You can imagine it's very, as I said, it's a mandrolic airplane, isn't it? And of course, unfortunately, Fly B have just gone under. So his dreams are shattered at the moment. So it's very real. It's not a great place. My brother is with Emirates at the moment. He's a first officer on 777s flying out of Dubai. And, you know, I know what he's saying. It's a great airline, Emirates. The airline itself recognize there's an issue, because people, they just haven't got the traffic going through. So like many airlines at the moment, there's this whole, maybe take some unpaid leave, you know, and so it is difficult for these guys, most definitely.
I know your brother, Tim, and I've seen his Instagram. He seems to be doing all right for himself.
Oh, I wasn't going to talk about that. All right, fair enough. Don't drag me in there. Don't drag me in. I'll get in trouble. I will get in trouble. Yeah, I mean, you phone me up and say, "Oh, you're on a podcast again, talking badly about me." Yeah, I've got to go and see him, actually. I must admit, out there at some point. All I ever get back, as you're right, on his Instagram, is him sitting by the pool with millions of hostesses. So, yeah.
I was biting my tongue earlier when you and Tim were talking about the Reds, because you've been wonderfully vocal about some of the bigger issues surrounding them as a squadron, haven't you? But
I completely believe in that, and unfortunately, yeah. I'll keep saying that until they have another accident. But I am a fan of all the guys in the team. Don't get me wrong, I always have been, ever since 2011. I'm a big advocate for the people that go into that team. But for me, the assurance of the team is obviously better now. I just don't think it goes far enough, and that's just a personal thing. And I must admit, I'm stepping away from that now, by the way, because the more I'm out of the service, the less sighted I am of it. I get lots of emails, of course, from people talking about all sorts of things, and I have to be very careful about what I socialize. You know, the service is stressed, and one of the areas that is stressed, of course, is the team. But it is what it is. Yeah.
Big shout out from me. You know, I'm a Navy Wings fan. I like to support the work they do. They've just released a statement about the Sea Vixen restoration. Two and a half years ago, that was put down on a wheels up at Yeovilton, wasn't it? Gosh, it just doesn't seem that long ago. And they've been working really, really hard to do as much as they can to repair the aircraft, but they've hit the stage now where they need major capital investment, and they are going out to see if they can get some specialist support on fundraising, see if they can secure some significant high net worth fundraising opportunities. But anything you can do, you know, we always give them a shout when we can, but go over, see if you can support them. And if you know anyone who's got a couple of million and they're not going to give it to Tim Davies for errorless, then
give it to me, mine.
Then please do everything you can to support Navy Wings. It's a great cause, and as we know, they've moved into the civil sector. It's now civil charity. The aircraft are being transferred over to the civil register, so it's massive change there at a time when they need every penny to get the second Swordfish flying. And get all the other aircraft through the winter season to the air show season in the summer. They've hit this snag. So anything you can do to support them, that would be fantastic. Okay.
Here for that one.
Yeah, we're very lucky. We've talked about it a lot of times. Yeah. And, you know, viruses and things aside, we're very lucky to have the air show circuit that we've got, and Navy Wings and the Memorial Flight, the RAF Memorial Flight. You know, we're really, really lucky. We talked about the Vulcan earlier, and we've lost that, and don't we all really, really miss it now? So do what you can to support them.
Listen, I haven't got long. It's about The Aviation Historian, the magazine the mainstream monthlies don't want you to know about. It's a new compact format quarterly journal, exploring the less well-known paths of flying history. It's created by experienced, award-winning former Aeroplane magazine editors Mick Oakey and Nick Stroud. It's not in the shops, but you can get it via the website, theaviationhistorian.com.
We know you're in there.
They're coming for me. I've got to go. Remember, The Aviation Historian.
And I think that's about it. Unless there's any other mentions, I think that's just about as far as we get today. We'd like to thank White Hearts and Peter Dixon for their contributions to the show. And we'd also like to thank Mick Oakey and the team at The Aviation Historian for helping to promote the programme. If you feel able, please leave us some feedback on iTunes or your podcast playing app. Like and score us on our Facebook page. It always helps us to know what you think about the programmes we produce. Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask before using anything you hear. The programme's produced with a Creative Commons licence. Tim Davies, where can we find you online?
I am all over the place online. In fact, I must admit... Where am I now? To be honest, Fast Ship Performance is probably the best place. I do run the spin recovery program as well for men going through transitions and want to take back control. So that's spinrecovery.com. That's a course that's 12 weeks online that I'm running at the moment. We have active spin teams at the moment going through that. So if you're in a very, if you're in a bit of a spin in your life, then by all means, Tim at fastshipperformance.com and let's get on a chat for 20 minutes. But Fast Ship Performance is probably the best place. Tim Davies _UK at Twitter. Twitter's a nightmare, isn't it? But I tend to have to kind of do a bit of that as well. And that's probably the best place to track me down. I think there's a YouTube channel as well that I keep posting into. And there's a podcast, of course, isn't there? Fast Ship Performance, where I talk about things that interest me, which tend to be things about mental health in men and stuff like this.
And we'll put links on the in the show notes to all of those.
Very kind.
Tim Robinson.
I'm RAS Tim R on Twitter for all aviation news and terrible flying related puns, and aerosociety.com for the Royal Aeronautical Society.
And Gareth, where can we find you?
I don't think there's anything wrong with Tim Robinson's puns. I'm going to come out and say that now. Gareth _Stringer on Twitter, and you'll find everything for Global Aviation Resource at globalaviationresource.com.
And you can find me at Nascot Hornet on Twitter. And, of course, you can find all of us on our Twitter and Facebook pages, Aviation Extended, all one word. Missing out the E. So that's it with the arrival of the music. It's goodbye from Tim Davies.
I unmute goodbye. Thank you. It's very good.
And it's goodbye from Tim Robinson.
Bye. See you next time.
Goodbye from Gareth.
Thanks for listening. See you next time.
Yeah, it's been a great episode. Thanks, everyone. It's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
Extended would like to thank its partners, Global Aviation Resource, the Royal Aeronautical Society, and XTP Media, for their support in helping to present and produce the programme.
The cockpit's very cramped, you've got leg restraints on, you're sat on a seat that's got explosives in it.
Just taking me on the trip of a lifetime in a F-18F Super Hornet.
Thanks for listening to Extended. We'll see you next time. And don't forget, we want you to contact us. So get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk is the email address you need.
I'm more handsome than the three of us, but...
You got fighter pilot looks.
I can't deny that, unfortunately. Well, the hair's got a bit long now. I've got a beard, so...
Got a garage full of toilet paper and pasta. I mean, what is going on?
Yeah, I'm self-isolating with Corona Lager at the moment, so I'm doing well.
Broadsword calling Danny Boy. Broadsword calling Danny Boy. Come in, Danny Boy.
And they've also recently had problems with the... my brain's gone to mush. With the... What's their
Starliner?
Starliner.
Yep.
Right.
Just make everything. Just say everything. They had problems with everything.
Yeah, I'll edit that out. Sorry about that.
Hi, I'm Tim Davies, and I'll start again. I do this all the time. Yeah,
it's all right. It's me.
We're not all listening.
Oh, for you guys are. and you're listening to Extended, right? Okay.
Yeah. Just messaging your brother.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, give him a text. I've got to go and see him soon. He's got his beach body and everything, isn't it? Yeah. Right. Okay. I'll do it now. Okay.
Extended.
This is XTP Media.